taken under advisement. The next case this morning is Alexander versus City of South Bend. Broden, Ms. Ivanovich,
good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel John Broden. I'm Roseanne Ivanovich, and I represent Richard Alexander in this case. I'm pleased to say that Richard Alexander is in the courtroom today. Briefly introduce you to him. And I'm here to tell you, it's truly by the grace of God and Officer Ryan Harmon of the Indiana State Police that Richard is out of prison. He did 5.5 years. He was wrongfully imprisoned, and it is through that their efforts, Ryan Harmon's efforts, that he today enjoys his liberty. It was through DNA evidence that he was freed, and it's that evidence that truly brought to light how the South Bend Police Department ensnared him and caused him to be convicted, caused him to go to trial twice before he was convicted.
I'm going to put it right out on the table.
Okay.
Ms. Ivanovich, your brief doesn't set forth the evidence that was presented at trial, nor does it explain how the photo arrays, lineup, or interview deprived Mr. Alexander of a fair trial. And so we need to know what is the basis for your due process claim.
If you look at, I believe it's tab 1 of the appendix, you can see that one of the photo arrays, this is representative of some of these photo arrays, there's a Hispanic man in there. Officer Schellinger was the individual who was taking around these photo arrays. She said in depositions that they were sort of all in a frenzy to try to get the person doing this. So they put together a bunch of pictures of anybody who came in as Crime Stoppers tips. They didn't take any care to put together photos of similar people. They just threw him in with the one gentleman is clearly Hispanic in there. None of those gentlemen look like Richard Alexander. The two guys who eventually were caught, the two actual rapists who weren't working together, who had two separate MOs, they don't look like Richard Alexander. By taking these photo arrays to these victims and the one witness, they kept seeing Richard Alexander's picture. Officer Wernt sat down with the witness after she had seen Richard Alexander's photo and then did a photo composite. They kept showing his photo. They had at least two or three photos at different times of Richard and kept showing him to these victims. These are victims who said that initially said they never even saw the attacker's face. The guy had some kind of a hood over his face. He would attack him in the dark. He'd shine a flashlight in their face so they couldn't see. Some of these were like elderly women in their 70s that would have a flashlight shined into their eyes in the middle of the night.
Was there cross-examination of these witnesses that might have effectively revealed the inadequacies of their identification?
There was cross-examination, but by that point, the damage had already been done. When they went into the lineup, one of the officers had told at least one of the victims that there would be a there was a suspect in that lineup. The one witness who had seen an attack from through her window at night in the rain and all this so on and so forth, she said afterwards, "I knew who he was right when he walked out on the stage," because she had seen his picture a couple times before then already. She was the one who sat down and did the composite after seeing his picture.
The problem, counsel, is that you have not identified any particular in-court identifications during the course of the trial which resulted in your client's conviction that flowed from the allegedly unconstitutional lineup and photo array procedures. The dots have not been connected for us, and I think that's what the questions that have been asked so far are attempted to get at, and I don't hear a satisfactory answer yet.
Okay, the two rapes that he was convicted of, originally he was charged with 4, 6, it's multiple, but the two that he was convicted of, both of those women did not see their attacker's face, were then shown photo arrays, then attended this lineup where they could all of a sudden identify him, and then testified at trial. The first trial ended in a hung jury. He was then tried again. I spoke to his criminal defense attorney, who said the second time the women were absolutely, as he pointed, damn sure that it was Richard at that point when they pointed him out. It was that progression of the police showing these photos, and that led to him being convicted.
Well, I'm assuming from what you're saying that they in fact made in-court identifications of your
yes,
client.
Yes, they did.
Okay. That's what I was waiting to hear.
I'm sorry.
And that's not in the briefs, and as far as I could see, it was not alluded to. But evidently these two witnesses of the two rapes that he was convicted of, the two victims, did in fact make in-court identifications, and it's your contention that those in-court identifications flowed from the unconstitutional pretrial identification procedures.
Absolutely.
Okay. And what was unconstitutional about those pretrial identification procedures?
The fact that these photo arrays were not put together properly. The female detective who was putting them together had been in the sex crimes unit for a very brief period of time.
Okay. That's not unconstitutional. Tell us what was unconstitutional about the photo arrays, apart from an inexperienced detective.
Okay. In her own letter that is in there, she cites failure to train. She was not trained by anybody in how to put photo arrays together. She didn't put them together with any care at all.
Okay, this is very general, counsel. You need to be more specific. What was unconstitutionally suggestive about the photo array? Just to say that they weren't put together with care doesn't give us anything.
The fact that a photo array should be put together with people who look similar.
Okay.
And they weren't put together in that manner.
What was dissimilar about the photos?
If you look at them, there's a couple guys that are bald. The victims had at some point felt the head of the attacker and said that he had very short hair. The lineup, there were at least two bald guys. There was a guy with like long hair in the background, in the back, a ponytail. They described a guy that their descriptions were all over because there were two attackers. But they described a guy of, you know, different heights. And when you look at the lineup, the guy in the center, he's well over 6 feet. And the attacker was in that kind of like 5'7", 5'8" range. The attacker was described as a young man. The two guys were, I believe, like 18 and 21. Richard was, I believe, 28, 29 at the time. There's guys of all ages. When they did the voice identification, when you do a voice lineup, you should not be able to see the person. All you should be doing is listening to a voice. Well, Richard came from an area, a neighborhood that's kind of got that street kind of slang to it. All the other guys in the lineup, they're all police officers, they're all firemen, and literally, one of the women said, that she knew it was him because of the way he said the word bitch.
Ms. Ivanovich, well, let me just ask you this because time is going to start to run out. Is your argument that the improper photo arrays, lineups, witness interviews are independently actionable under Section 1983 regardless of their impact on the fairness of the trial itself? Is that your argument?
Yes, and also because of the impact on the trial.
If yes, that is contrary to our opinion in Hensley. And that is a problem here.
The way I read Hensley is we need to establish a nexus between the poor police procedures and the violation of his core right to a fair trial, which there was a violation of that. I mean, that's the only way he was convicted. There was no physical evidence. There was nothing to tie him to this. When they finally came up with mitochondrial DNA, then they realized through that testing that it was confirmed it was not him. One of the perpetrators finally admitted. He'd done like over 300 attacks. Guilt finally got to him.
At trial, how many, because your brief doesn't tell us this, at trial, how many of the witnesses identified Alexander as the perpetrator?
There were two victims and one witness at trial, and they were all identifying him at that point.
Was there a motion to suppress the in-court identifications based on a suggestive pretrial identification procedures? In other words, was this issue litigated in the criminal trial?
It was litigated, yes.
All right. And what I assume the suppression motion was denied because you've now told us that there was
right.
in-court identification testimony.
Correct. And he had also, Attorney Corporal, who was the defense attorney, had also asked for an instruction to the jury concerning the identifications, and that was denied, and that did go up on appeal.
Okay. So the trial judge concluded that the identification procedures, the pretrial identification procedures in this case, were not unduly suggestive, presumably because the identifications were permitted
presumably,
to be made in court.
I mean, there was cross-examination on it, but at that point, I believe the damage had already been done because they were so sure. How can people who have never seen their attacker all of a sudden have the face of the attacker? How can they all of a sudden describe him? How can a witness who describes some guy with a really nice haircut, real trendy haircut, that was her description, all of a sudden now she can, you know, pick him out, and that's after seeing his picture a few times.
But you're suggesting that there should not have been any pretrial identification procedures engaged in by the police at all because the victims said initially that they couldn't see his face clearly.
How can you show photos to somebody who hasn't seen a face? I see a voice lineup would have been very appropriate.
So from the get-go, any attempt by the police to have the victims identify their attacker was unconstitutional?
If the person hasn't seen their face?
Well, that would be a pretty novel proposition, that if a victim initially says, I didn't get a clear look at his face, so the police are forbidden
You're
constitutionally?
Saying, I didn't see his face. I couldn't identify him.
So your position is that the police at that point forever are forbidden from attempting to have the victim identify an attacker?
Not by face. They shouldn't. They shouldn't. You can do a hand lineup. The one said she saw his chest, that he had a tattoo of, I can't remember what it was, but he had a tattoo. He didn't have a tattoo. They could have done a chest lineup. There's so many ways that they could have done this. They had time.
Was cross-examination done on all these points that you're raising?
Cross was done, yes. But at that point, as I said...
If we look in the record, we'll find an indication where both witnesses said they did not see his face, right?
Right. Right back to the police reports that are in the appendix where it says that they didn't see the face.
And that issue was raised on cross?
Yes.
So that one of us doesn't have to search every word of the record, I would like to know where we will find that.
That may take me a couple minutes to...
Perhaps you...
To locate that.
Why don't you wait till you do a rebuttal?
Yeah.
I could do that on rebuttal. Additionally, if there are no questions, I'd like to touch on the issue of the destruction of the DNA evidence, if I may. Officers Eastman and Schellinger both threw out Richard Alexander's DNA and the victim's DNA evidence. Schellinger, in an officer's report, cited her lack of training for her reason for throwing it out. And then she claimed that some Indiana State police lab worker had told her that it was of no value. I took the deposition of those Indiana State lab workers, and they've been doing this for a long time. They would never tell anybody that it had no value. One of the lab workers indicated that she has gone back to evidence that's 20 years old, blood evidence and hair evidence. The lab supervisor stated that she would never tell anyone that.
What was the harm that was done because the government is arguing that that portion...
That there was no harm.
That there was no harm.
He was ready with his attorney to go to trial when the prosecutor was told by the police, oh, by the way, we don't have the DNA evidence anymore. We threw it out. A jury was sitting there waiting to go to trial. And his attorney at that time said, we're ready to go to trial.
No, but you're missing the point, I'm afraid.
He said
that the technicians, according to the government, had already completed their analysis and concluding that there was indeed no match found between the DNA of Ms. Wozniak and the DNA of the plaintiff.
They also had thrown
and
out...
And that there was no match from the rape kit.
And they also had thrown out his DNA evidence. And I believe he has a right to have that preserved. They pulled out...
What was the harm? Of course...
He sat for another 106 days while the state continued his trial. Another 106 days of loss of his liberty.
But then is the government misstating when the government says as soon as Officer Schellinger and the South Bend Police Department became aware that there was not a match, the St. Joseph prosecuting attorney dismissed all charges against the plaintiff stemming from the attack on Ms. Wozniak?
After that day of trial, yeah. They were right in there. I have that transcript from that hearing in there. And the judge was saying, we've got however many jurors sitting out there, we're ready to go. And the state is saying, well, we can't go now because I just learned this morning that they threw out the DNA evidence. This was the second time they had thrown out DNA evidence. And Officer Eastman, when I deposed her, she flat out lied. She lied and said she had never done it before. I have the case, and I've got her officer's report. I didn't show it to her at her deposition, but I've got her officer's report where
I'm confused, perhaps, in your response to Judge Rovner. The state wasn't using that to seek as part of their evidence for conviction, were they?
They said they could not proceed because they didn't even know at that point what had been thrown out. That's what it says in the transcript. They were very, very concerned about their case.
Well,
their case
let me,
was
let me put it another way.
Point.
As part of the evidence they were using against your client, mm-hmm. was the information disclosed by the rape kits?
True.
What were they using from that as the evidence in support of their conviction?
I suppose at that point they thought it was going to point to him as having committed this. But it
so in the list of evidence that they indicated they'd use at trial, it was information from those rape kits?
Right.
And then there came a point, I guess, where they said no, they weren't going to use it?
At the morning of trial, the prosecutor didn't know what to do. He really didn't. He said they weren't prepared to proceed.
He dismissed all charges, correct?
After that. He didn't dismiss them that immediately.
All right. We want to save a little bit of time for rebuttal. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Mr. Broden, maybe you'd like to pick up right where we left off. What happened at the beginning, had the jury sitting there ready to go to trial? What happened?
Well, there was a trial date scheduled, and the St. Joseph County Prosecuting Attorney's Office became aware that a sexual rape kit had been destroyed. They immediately asked for a continuance of the trial. However, the charges that stemming from that rape kit had been dismissed long ago,
This is the Wozniak case.
Yeah, Connie Wozniak. That's exactly correct. Her case had been dismissed long before they even knew that the rape kit had been disposed of. The rape kit, as I understood it, was only going to be presented to show that why those charges had been dismissed. Officers Eastman and Schellinger, and again, these are frankly things that I think are somewhat out of the record, but Officers Schellinger and Eastman were always upset that they had been frankly scapegoated in the papers and such as the reason for the continuance of the trial, because Connie Wozniak's charges and anything to do with that rape kit had already been dismissed. It was more just an embarrassment, frankly, and something that reflected poorly on the state's case that they didn't have this piece of evidence that I think they had intended to use at trial, only to show that they had as to why those charges had been dismissed. That's the only thing I can speculate on. I was not part of the prosecution team.
I know, but in Indiana, don't they provide a list of witnesses and exhibits? Was that included as a list of exhibits?
I would suspect that it would have had to have been, yes.
They didn't have it, right?
That would be true, that they certainly would not have any, they would not have that piece of evidence. But again, I'm not sure how the defendant would have been harmed by that, only from the standpoint of I don't understand what they would have been preparing for in terms of that exhibit, knowing that there weren't going to be any charges stemming from any.
It wasn't going to be used to try to support a conviction.
Yeah, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Well, now, Mr. Alexander is asserting that his trial was delayed 106 days because of the destruction of the evidence from the lab. Can you explain why the 106-day delay was granted and whether or not it was related to the destruction of the evidence?
Well, I can certainly tell you that when the prosecuting attorney moved for the continuance of the trial, they did indeed cite this destruction of the DNA evidence and the fact that they would not have this, and I'll refer to it as a prop, as a reason for their motion to continue, and the court, for whatever reason, chose to grant the prosecution's request.
Would the court be aware how would the court be aware how that was going to be used?
I don't think the court could have been aware as to how it was going to be used. I would only state, though, that again, I think it's important to focus on what that rape kit was. And what that rape kit was proof, and frankly was the prosecuting attorney going above and beyond the typical call of duty to be fair in the criminal trial. And that was to explain that DNA evidence was taken of Richard Alexander, that there was no match in this particular case. And as a matter of fact, they did present that at the subsequent trial. They ended up having the individual from the state police lab come and testify to that fact. And I think that's what they were going to use that rape kit for. However, again, important to note what that rape kit was. That rape kit consisted of an exoneration of Richard Alexander in a case where charges had already been dismissed. It's not clear to me, as someone reviewing the record, why the prosecution team didn't go forward on that day of trial without the rape kit.
Because the destruction of the physical evidence did not mean that the results of the testing could not come into evidence.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's exactly right. I think there's something they viewed as valuable to the actual prop being the kit itself, but it was not as though the kit was anything more than what easily could have been gotten, as they did when they subsequently held the trial 106 days later. They called as a witness a woman named Lynn Scammahorn from the Indiana State Police Lab, who testified to that exact same fact, that there was no match between Richard Alexander and Connie Wozniak from a DNA standpoint, and of course those charges had already been dismissed.
Now, you have argued in your brief that Mr. Alexander is estopped from presenting arguments that could have been raised in the criminal trial, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Should it matter to that estoppel agreement that the decision in that criminal trial has been vacated?
Well, I think, again, that what we would argue, what the city would argue, is that what Indiana law observes from an estoppel standpoint or from a issue preclusion standpoint is, did he have a full and fair opportunity to raise these issues at the criminal trial? And this goes back to what the court, I believe, was talking about or was asking questions about on plaintiff's presentation, which is, did Mr. Alexander indeed have an opportunity to fully vet all these issues at the criminal trial? And in fact, he did. In fact, we included, the city included, and it's in the record, we included all of the cross-examination that was done at the criminal trial by the plaintiff's trial counsel, because we believe that that demonstrates that he did indeed obtain a fair trial, and he had, and again, getting back to your specific question about the issue of preclusion and estoppel, is that all Indiana law requires, as we read it, is that the parties have been given a full and fair opportunity to raise these issues at the criminal trial. Some of these issues were raised, some perhaps were not, but all of these, in our opinion, could have been raised and should have been raised at the criminal trial.
Doesn't there have to be a judgment which is entitled to preclusive effect, though? And the point is that there is no longer any judgment since it was vacated?
Well, I view it more that that it says there has to be a full and fair opportunity to raise these issues at trial. And in fact, the fact that those findings are subsequently set aside in a criminal context, we believe from a municipal liability standpoint, from a Section 1983 standpoint, there still has to be some credence given to that criminal trial that took place, because that's all that these Section 1983 rights require, and that is the core right, the right to a fair trial. If we suddenly say that there was no trial at all, I don't see how we can analyze these Section 1983 rights, because I think, as I understand it, all that the plaintiff has been raising is these attacks on prophylactic rights, that the photo arrays could have been better, that the lineup could have been better, that the lineup could have included people who look more similar. But those all go to so-called due process rights, which in and of themselves only go toward the protection of the core right, which is a right to a fair trial. So suddenly the city is put in the perspective of not even being able to look to a trial. I think there still has to be some recognition of what happened at that trial.
Your argument is that the dismissal or the vacating the original decision was not based on a lack of fair trial, but because of DNA evidence.
Absolutely right, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. Just as we have maintained that just because you have a tragedy that occurs where an innocent person, a person who did not commit these crimes, is placed in jail, that, in the city's perspective, does not mean that there was not a fair trial. And likewise, just because an innocent man is placed in prison does not mean per se liability on behalf of the taxpayers and the police officers of the city of South Bend, that somehow there has to be, as the court referred to, a nexus, that somehow something that the city's police department did through the through the photo arrays or through the lineup, somehow deprived this plaintiff of his right to a fair trial. We believe it would be very difficult jurisprudence for a municipality to deal with if suddenly, just because a conviction is set aside because of DNA evidence, suddenly we say, well, there was never a trial, because we believe the trial is a critical point to look at in ascertaining whether the core right was protected, and we believe that the core right was protected.
What procedure was used to set aside that conviction?
Procedure, as I understand it, is that, and again, these are things that I don't want to get too astray on, but the city of South Bend, Officer Cindy Eastman in particular, who's a named defendant, had concerns about this conviction throughout.
Well, no, I meant what legal basis, how under the rules of criminal procedure was the case disposed of?
From looking at the transcript, a state public defender in coordination with the St. Joseph County prosecuting attorney filed a joint motion before the St. Joseph Superior Court indicating that the evidence that DNA evidence.
I understand that, but is there a criminal procedure rule that permits that?
If there is, I don't know what that rule is. I have read the transcript of the hearing by which.
Well, I know nobody's going to contest it, but I'm just saying it from the standpoint of we're arguing whether or not that's preclusive with regard to. Whether or not the city is liable, it may be a thing that nobody can test, but does not find a basis in the rules of criminal procedure.
Yeah, I.
How long after the conviction did it occur?
Well, I believe Ms. Ivanovich is correct in that regard. I do believe it was 5.5 years after the date of conviction is when the joint petition was filed.
The answer to my question may be somewhere in here, but I miss it if that's the case. How many rape kits were there?
I'm only aware of one rape kit that was going to be utilized at trial.
And that's the
Wozniak, yes.
Wozniak.
Yes. That's the only rape kit that I've ever been aware of that was going to be used at trial.
Because I'm wondering where the DNA came from.
Well, as indicated, as rapes continued to occur after Mr. Alexander was exonerated, well, I should say there were samples kept on file. This goes back to our no harm argument on the quote-unquote destruction of DNA evidence. The state of Indiana and the police have always maintained a sample for Connie Wozniak, even though her rape kit was destroyed, as we have, I hope, have indicated to the court, and I believe is expressly stated in the record, there was no harm done to Mr. Alexander from the standpoint of they were still able to conduct subsequent matches with Connie Wozniak's DNA. And then what they did was, as subsequent defendants came into the system, then their DNAs continued to be matched. A police officer with the South Bend Police Department, a named defendant, Cindy Eastman, continued to send samples every time she had a rape case that he had a similar MO or was in this neighborhood or in the city. She would send that for a match.
I know, but these are different rape victims.
Yes,
these
yes,
aren't the rape victims that were involved.
Different rape suspects and different rape assailants, but they would then try to match those with Connie Wozniak's DNA.
Why would that be relevant to anything?
Well,
it's not her DNA that counts. It's the evidentiary sample. And whether there's a match between the evidentiary sample that's on the victim and the particular suspect.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding what the court is asking, because I guess what I'm trying to articulate is the reason why it's relevant is it's that for Mr. Alexander to be harmed, if you had destroyed Connie Wozniak's, well, I suppose I see what the court is saying. I guess all I'm trying to say is that harm to the defendant, in my opinion, through the destruction of DNA evidence would be harm where you are unable to prove your innocence because evidence has been destroyed. That is not what happened here.
Do you know the extent to which the identification procedures were litigated in the criminal trial?
Well, The City of South Bend, in its motions for summary judgment, which are part of the record, we attached the cross-examination of each of the witnesses who testified.
I'm talking about pretrial. Not in the cross-examination, but pretrial. Was there a motion to suppress the in-court identifications on the basis of unconstitutional or unduly suggestive pretrial identification procedures?
I heard Ms. Ivanovich refer to that. I had not seen that. I only saw cross-examination in the trial, and when the photos and the lineups were offered as evidence, there was no objection to those offered at trial.
So there was no motion to suppress, and the state court never had an opportunity to rule on any constitutional objection to the pretrial lineup and photo array procedures?
I'm only saying this, that I have not seen the transcript of that motion. I have not seen an order on that motion. I don't think it's a record before the court, unless it's something that I've overlooked. I have only seen the vigorous cross-examination that occurred at trial of those witnesses with respect to their identification in the photo lineup and what they saw and what they told police officers. Vigorous cross-examination for all the jurors to hear in that regard.
Well, it seems to me that if anything is entitled to preclusive effect, it would be a ruling by the state court on a constitutional claim about the lineup and the photo arrays, since the judgment itself has been vacated. And you're telling me you don't know the answer to that question. You don't know if there was ever a motion to suppress or if the state court was ever asked to rule on the constitutionality of those pretrial procedures.
That is correct, Your Honor. I cannot sit here today and say that that I have read that. The essence of the city's case has...
Before you get to that,
sorry.
Let's clear out this one more. This rape kit, apparently the only one involved. How many DNA samples were obtained in that rape kit through that rape?
In reading the testimony of the state police laboratory person who put that together, I don't remember her quantifying it in terms of a number.
Well, let me put it another way. How does the DNA of the victim exonerate the plaintiff in this case? Wouldn't it have to be DNA of a male which did not match the victim? Plaintiff in this case.
How was he ultimately exonerated?
So there's no DNA match, but where's the sample that's different from a different rapist?
Well, my understanding is that the match that occurred is between the suspect who was ultimately apprehended and convicted, that there was a match between
him. Where was that match located?
It was located through the ongoing work of the South Bend Police Department and subsequent crimes, and they continued to send those samples to the lab to match those with Connie Warziniak's sample.
And how would that tell us? It would match what?
Well, the male sample that was commingled with hers
was
later found.
There are two samples. That is part of the confusion, I think, we're talking about. We're not just talking about her DNA, but whoever the unknown male was involved. So there are two samples, male and female DNA samples.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct, yes. And now I understand what the court was asking. Yes, that is correct. And again... The essence of the city's case has been that as we read the plaintiff's grounds for relief, they articulate due process grounds for relief. And my review of the case law, and of course I defer to the court, is that this is not a negligent standard for the South Bend Police Department. These due process violations, in fact, I believe the Sixth Circuit case of Hutzel versus Sayre referred to there having to be some sort of extraordinary circumstances. And footnote 4 of the Hensley versus Carey case that was discussed earlier, referred to a case, I believe it was Kerr versus City of Chicago, where you had a physical beating, essentially, that led to a confession, and that obviously violated a due process right, that right against self-incrimination. The entire record that is before the court in the city's eyes is void of any of those things that we think would view that would strike someone as being extraordinary circumstances. That in fact, certainly in looking back, I'm certain that as there is with any serial investigation of a rapist, there could have been photo arrays that they could have been better. There could have been a lineup that possibly could have been better. All those things could have been looked at and possibly could have been done better, but none rise to the level of extraordinary circumstances that would constitute a violation of that core right, the right to a fair trial, and where you would see someone who has been abridged of that core right.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Ivanovich, you have 1 minute, but I'll give you two.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have your answer to Judge Rovner's question?
Yes. Tabs 22, 23, and 24, in all those police reports, you can see in various portions of them where 22, she said she did not see his face. 23, the boxes checked where no suspect could be identified. And 24, same thing, no suspect could be identified. And it goes into there further about how they could not see his face. And to be honest, I may have misspoke when I said there was a motion to suppress. I don't think there was. I was kind of confused.
I don't think there was either.
Yeah, I was kind of...
That was my next
question.
I'm a little
flustered today. So. Also, in the transcript of that hearing in which Richard sat for another 106 days, the court had said, but the state is prepared then and does have the evidence to go forward today on counts 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 10, 11, and 12, question. The prosecutor said, I would say we would have the evidence, I think, in light of the facts and circumstances with the other situations, although theoretically we could go forward. Factually, no, we're not prepared with respect to any count at this point. He had also said that he was receiving conflicting information as to what suspects' kits had been destroyed. There was a question as to they didn't know what had been destroyed at that point. And to answer your question, it was a hair that was found on the pajama pants of Gwen Jensen that had a root to it that led to one of the individuals. The other individual confessed. And so part of it was through DNA and part of it was through confession. It was Officer Ryan Harmon of the Indiana State Police who solved this case. I just want to reiterate that. There were several things that were not litigated. The fact that there was no probable cause for the initial stop. They were, and this goes right back to my conspiracy claim. They were looking for a white guy that happened to be in the evening on a bicycle in a black male in an all-white neighborhood. And he just happened to be there. He had a reason to be there. They checked out why he was there. They wanted to take DNA from him that night. They had no probable cause to stop him. That the loss of his liberty due to the destruction of evidence, that was never litigated.
Let me just ask real quickly. The other rape he was convicted of was Heidi Holdridge's?
I believe it's Gwen Jensen and Heidi Holdridge. There's also a Lisa Eck, and I get those two confused. He was convicted of the two of them. He was sentenced to 70 years. And it was two different perpetrators who had done those two different rapes. It's different MOs. I guess just sort of in summary, I feel so strongly that this is a case that needs to go to a jury. I want the jury to hear this case so badly. I want Richard to have his day in court so badly. He sat there for 5.5 years begging for anyone to listen to him. And it's just a miracle that he's out. So.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both attorneys, and the case will be taken under advisement. We move to the third case.